From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's program, the US leads international condemnation over the brutal slaughter of an American journalist by Islamic State terrorists.
When people harm Americans anywhere, we do what's necessary to see that justice is done, and we act against ISIL, standing alongside others.
Also today, the very latest on the reaction to the shooting of Michael Brown as the US Attorney General arrives in Ferguson, Missouri, and why worrying noises from an Icelandic volcano could be bad news for European air travel.
If this volcano does go off, and if the ash does come down, there will be those airlines that will be able to fly, and those airlines that will take the long view and decide not to.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. U.S. President Barack Obama is vowing to bring the killers of American journalist James Foley to justice. He says the entire world is appalled by the brutality meted out to the detained reporter, and he pledged to continue fighting Islamic State forces in Iraq and Syria. Our Washington correspondent Simon Marks reports.
President Obama interrupted his holiday and told reporters that the beheading of James Foley shocks the conscience of the world. Far from retreating in the battle against Islamic State militants, he vowed to continue taking the fight to them.
The United States of America will continue to do what we must do to protect our people. We will be vigilant and we will be relentless.
The president did not mention a second U.S. journalist, Stephen Sotloff, now threatened with death by Islamic State as the U.S. airstrikes continue.
Meanwhile, the parents of James Foley have been speaking about their son's legacy. Talking to journalists outside their home in New Hampshire, John and Diane Foley asked for mercy for other Americans being held abroad. Diane Foley also said that she hopes some good can come out of her son's death.
Jim had a big heart, and that's what we shared with President Obama. You know, we just pray that Jim's death can bring our country together in a stronger way, and with the values that Jim held dear.
Palestinian militant group Hamas says Israel has killed the wife and son of one of Hamas's top military commanders in an airstrike. Mohammed Deif has long been a target for Israel, escaping multiple assassination attempts, but Hamas says he remains unharmed, with his family the casualties. Approximately 20 people have died since fighting resumed between Israeli forces and Hamas yesterday, following a ceasefire collapse. America's top law enforcement official arrived in Ferguson, Missouri on Wednesday, just hours after protesters took to the street for the 11th straight night of demonstrations over the killing death of an unarmed black teenager by a white police officer. Attorney General Eric Holder will lead a federal investigation into the shooting and plans to meet with community leaders in an effort to restore peace to the city. FSN's Patrice Howard reports from Ferguson.
Holder took out an op-ed in a St. Louis newspaper before his arrival, confirming that he will focus on advancing the ongoing investigation into Brown's death by examining evidence and working with local officials to determine what caused police officer Darren Wilson to shoot the teenager 6 times. He will also examine the results of a federal autopsy conducted on the victim's body to see if it supports results of the private autopsy ordered by Brown's family.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Afghanistan's attorney general has ordered that an American journalist be expelled from the country. Matthew Rosenberg, a correspondent for the New York Times newspaper, published an article on Tuesday deemed by the attorney general's office to be harmful to Afghan security. Lorna Shattuck reports from Washington.
Matthew Rosenberg's story, published by the New York Times on Tuesday, was about officials discussing plans to form an interim government in Afghanistan if deadlock over the presidential election failed to break soon, an action that would effectively amount to a coup. He was then summoned for questioning and said he and the newspaper have been cooperating fully. Attorney General Mohammed Ishaq Aloko released a statement on Wednesday, though, calling Mr. Rosenberg's article divisive and contrary to the national interest, security and stability of Afghanistan. He added that Mr. Rosenberg must leave the country within 24 hours. The State Department in Washington criticized Afghanistan's handling of the situation on Tuesday and said it was deeply disturbed by the Attorney General's actions.
And a security expert says Chinese hackers exploited the Heartbleed internet bug to steal data on up to 4.5 million U.S. patients. It's the first known breach of a company using the vulnerability. Rebecca Bowring reports from San Francisco.
David Kennedy, chief executive of the trusted sex cybersecurity company, says sources close to the investigation have confirmed hackers accessed the system via Heartbleed. The hospital chain Community Health revealed on Monday that the intrusion originated in China and that hackers took patients' social security numbers, names and addresses. They used stolen credentials to log onto the network as employees, then penetrated a database of personal information. Heartbleed is a security flaw in the OpenSSL encryption software used by web browsers and email to protect sensitive data. Community Health Systems has not responded to the claim. Rebecca Bowring, San Francisco.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports.
The United States of America will continue to do what we must do to protect our people. We will be vigilant and we will be relentless. When people harm Americans anywhere, we do what's necessary to see that justice is done, and we act against ISIL, standing alongside others.
The U.S. president reacting Wednesday to the video footage of the murder of U.S. journalist James Foley at the hands of Islamic State extremists. During the video, a militant dressed in black, brandishing a knife, says Mr. Foley's death was revenge for American airstrikes against the IS in Iraq. In the same video, the life of a second captive U.S. journalist, Stephen Sotloff, is threatened if the U.S. continues its bombing campaign. 40-year-old James Foley was on assignment for Agence France-Presse and Boston's Global Post when he was abducted in Syria back in 2012. In response to the news of his death, the Foley family remembered their son's bravery and pleaded for compassion for his fellow captives.
We beg compassion.
Yeah, and mercy.
We beg compassion and mercy of Jim's captors, for Stephen Sotloff and for the other captives. We just beg mercy. They never hurt anybody. They were trying to help, and there's no reason for their slaughter.
Both US and British security agencies are still analysing the content of the video. However, the Islamic State militant in the footage appears to speak with a British accent, putting the spotlight on the UK's response and the involvement of British nationals in IS. Our UK correspondent, Dan Whitehead, reports.
The American journalist James Foley had reported from across the Middle East. He fed back accounts of the extreme violence there, but also of the will to find out who the people there really were and the stories behind them. His mother, Diane, said he gave his life trying to expose the suffering of the people in Syria. In the UK, the British Prime Minister David Cameron returned to Downing Street from holiday early to chair emergency meetings on the situation, not least because the militant in the video appears to speak with a British accent. Some say this alone strengthens the argument for a tougher response from the UK government to Islamist militants.
Britain needs to consider airstrikes. It needs to consider intelligence operations, surveillance missions. Britain needs to act. But the number one reason why Britain needs to act is because the person who executed Foley happened to have an English accent and is presumed to be a British citizen. This is frightful for this country.
Dwayne Menezias from the Human Security Centre in London says Britain must be alert to what is happening on home soil.
This is not where ISIS is intimidating this country. It is where we need to look into what is happening in our domestic affairs. What are we growing in our backyards? It is a cancer that's going to corrode not only this society, but again pose an international threat.
The British Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond says the government is aware of a large number of British citizens travelling to the Middle East to join extremist groups such as IS. Erin Saltman from the Quilliam Foundation, a counter-extremism think tank, says change can only be achieved when those not susceptible to radicalisation stand up.
We have a very vocal minority and a very silent majority. And that could actually, if we could shift that majority to be more vocal, we could actually shift that tide a little bit.
However, Erin warns that any response must be carefully constructed.
When Western powers, without international agreement and without agreement from other Middle Eastern countries or the similar reflected aid from other Middle Eastern countries, goes forward and puts forth really attackative proposals and aggressive proposals, this does play directly into Islamic State rhetoric.
As the investigation into the video continues in both the US and in the UK, the British government is continuing to find itself in a difficult position over its military involvement in Iraq and the growing involvement of British nationals willing to fight there. Dan Whitehead, London.
Filmmaker and close friend of James Foley, Matthew Van Dyke, gave his reaction to the news of his murder on LBC Radio.
I'm horrified by the video. It's a nightmare seeing a friend of mine in that situation, and James, and also Stephen Sotloff, who's threatened to be next in the video. They're both good friends of mine, and to see them in that circumstance is absolutely horrible.
You yourself, having been held a prisoner, did you fear for your life when you were held captive in Libya?
Yes, certainly. I was sure I'd be executed or held in prison for 20 or 30 years when I was there.
In terms of James Foley's decision to return to a war zone after himself being held captive and then freed in Libya, did you ever speak to him about his decision to go back to a war zone and go back to those risks?
Yeah, he believed in what he was doing and he felt compelled to do it. I mean, he was captured by the Gaddafi regime and held, and after being released, after several weeks, he went back to Libya and continued reporting on that war. It showed remarkable courage and dedication to journalism. He was a true believer in the profession that he was in and wanting to get the story of people told to the world, and he was willing to take every risk for it.
And this is one of the key things, isn't it, that we wouldn't know about what's happening in these countries if we didn't have journalists like himself, and indeed yourself, who go out to these places and risk your life. But have things changed for independent journalists, foreign journalists, travelling in the Middle East and working in some of these countries? Has it become more dangerous than ever before, or was it always such a risk?
It was always a risk, but it's certainly become more dangerous in Syria. I've filmed in Iraq, Afghanistan, I've filmed in Libya and fighting in Libya as well, and Syria is certainly the most dangerous place by far. Just the multitude of threats and the inability to trust anybody, it's a whole different level of danger for any foreigner going into that country. And unfortunately, I worry that other groups in other places will be inspired instead of repulsed by what ISIS has done here.
What was your friend James Foley like? Jim Foley, who would be known to you. We've seen footage of him, obviously a very brave, very courageous man. What was he like as a friend?
He was a very kind person, very honest, fun to be around, very intelligent. And he was such a true professional. He wanted to do things the right way. He was very honest, very thorough in his work. He took things very seriously. He's one of the people I felt most comfortable with being in a conflict zone. There's some people, some journalists that make you nervous, but James is somebody that you could rely on and that you knew was going to take things seriously. He knew the risks, but he took calculated risks, and he took it very seriously. But, you know, he's, of all the journalists I know, James was James and Stephen Sotloff as well were my two best friends in that community, and it's a terrible loss for everyone who knew him.
Should this footage ever be shown by mainstream media?
You know, I had resisted watching it myself, and then I was asked so many times if I had watched it. So I went and watched it, thinking that it would help me be more prepared to speak about it. You know, once you watch it, you can't unwatch it. So I don't recommend that people watch it.
Filmmaker and friend of James Foley talking to Julia Hartley Brewer on LBC Radio. This is FSN Reports. The US Attorney General has arrived in the embattled St. Louis suburb of Ferguson. Eric Holder is there to assess the incident involving the deadly police shooting of unarmed black teenager Michael Brown by a local police officer 11 days ago. Mr. Holder met with community leaders and federal prosecutors after several days of protests and violent clashes in Ferguson. FSN's Kate Fisher is there.
Yes, Attorney General Eric Holder arrived here this morning. He went straight to Florissant Valley Community College, which is in North St. Louis, and there he met members of the community and students and spoke to them about their concerns and about what's been going on over the last 11 days. He told the students there, he promised them that change was coming. He's also here, though, to speak to investigators, federal investigators who are looking into this shooting, into the killing of Michael Brown. So he'll be briefed by them about what the latest is and where we are in the judicial process.
And he arrived following another night of protest on the Ferguson streets, but perhaps not the same level of violence this time round.
No, I was there last night and the night before, and it was a very different atmosphere, far less intimidating last night. The police seemed to have changed their tactics somewhat. The night before, they had stood in long lines, in full riot gear and armed, and kind of blocked off one end of the street in a very sort of aggressive manner and faced off, if you like, against protesters. Whereas last night, it was more like the protesters, they were marching and chanting in big circles up and down the street, but the police were in small pockets. They weren't lined up in big, intimidating rows, and it felt like it was a much less intimidating atmosphere. No shots were fired last night, no tear gas was released. Things did get a little bit more chaotic after about midnight, and there were more than 40 arrests. We're told police also had to use some pepper spray, but it certainly wasn't as serious as the night before.
Kate Fisher in Ferguson. This is FSN Reports. The risk of an eruption at Iceland's Bárðarbunga volcano is increasing. The country's meteorological office says there are signs of ongoing magma movement, sending airlines on alert, especially following an ash cloud event 4 years ago which shut down airspace over much of Europe for almost a week. Chris Yates is an aviation expert, and he gave his assessment of the threat to LBC.
But it seems likely that if this volcano does go off, we're not likely to see the sort of disruption that we saw just a few years ago, because there's been an awful lot of research done into the way that ash cloud travels and what you can fly in and what you can't fly in.
Modern aircraft, can't they now cope with things like ash clouds? I mean, would they necessarily have to deviate well away from the area? Just take us through the dangers.
Yeah, they would have to deviate away from the area, but that area is becoming smaller and smaller and smaller the more we know about how ash cloud disperses in the air. At the moment, there is no technology on board aircraft to check the air for the presence of ash, but that technology is coming. Next year, EasyJet hopes to be the first to install the system called Avoid on its airplanes, which effectively sends out a signal, an infrared signal from the aircraft, that looks ahead to identify where pockets of ash cloud exist.
And that would be quite a development, wouldn't it? 4 years ago, of course, Chris, the ash cloud caused a widespread disruption. We all remember it. Just remind us of the impact it had, though, for airlines and passengers at the time.
Well, of course, the ash cloud swept down from Iceland to blanket much of the UK and indeed parts of Europe. And that, in turn, effectively closed airports and grounded flights for, as you pointed out earlier, 6 days. And an awful lot of hot air was expended in the interim with various different leaders of the airline community complaining bitterly about the fact that they were grounded. Having said that, of course, one always has to err on the side of caution when talking about this sort of thing. And the fact of the matter is that if this volcano does go off and if the ash does come down over the United Kingdom, there will be those airlines that will be able to fly and those airlines that will take the long view and decide not to.
Aviation expert Chris Yates talking to LBC Radio. And finally, tonight, we return to our top story, the murder of US journalist James Foley, whose death at the hands of Islamic State militants was filmed and released as a warning to the US government to end its airstrikes against IS extremists in northern Iraq. Experts who have examined the video believe the militant who killed Mr. Foley spoke with a British accent and represents the worrying numbers of men recruited from across Europe to the ranks of the IS terror group. FSN's Ollie Barrett discussed the development with Erin Saltman, senior researcher at the Quilliam think tank in London, an expert on radicalisation.
Currently, the people that have been recognised as foreign fighters, it has either been through self-identification, oftentimes through social media. So often we have people that are tweeting about their experiences as foreign fighters that have profiles online that are explaining what they're going through and why they are fighting to people. Or we have the reactive approach where family members will come out and say this to intelligence. But other than that, it is very difficult to identify people. So it will be through either social media and online means of identification, or through family members or loved ones or known associates coming out and saying that they know who is talking.
We do see British Muslims travelling to places like Syria and Iraq. We've seen it also in Afghanistan and elsewhere too. Why is it? Why are they leaving this country to fight in these conflicts?
So foreign fighters currently going to fight with Islamic State, this is an unprecedented number of European foreign fighters. If you combined all the foreign fighters that left to fight in Afghanistan in the 10 years that a war was going on, we have already far surpassed the number just in the last 3 years with people willing to leave Europe and fight abroad. This trend is happening for a number of reasons. First and foremost, we originally saw that the narratives that governments were giving out, we had governments in Europe openly saying that they did not agree with the Syrian government, that they supported opposition to the government. And so oftentimes mainstream media and government rhetoric was not going against these extremist voices that were calling for assistance to come and help them fight. So we have a game changer a little bit in that respect, in that the mainstream moderate and governmental official voices were not actually countering the radicalized rhetoric.
That's shifted with Iraq, though, hasn't it? It's a different emphasis, but they're still going?
This has shifted with Iraq, but it also points out perhaps some disjunctures and some hypocrisy in how governments are attacking or targeting opposition and extremist groups. So the fact that a government would be really willing to attack Islamic State in Iraq, but not during the Syrian crisis or vice versa, it's showing kind of some lines and disjunctures, and actually Islamic State are using any of these cracks in the rhetoric to support their own propaganda, support why there's hypocrisy in mainstream governments, why the West is flimsy and targeting Muslims as a whole, so it plays into their own propaganda and rhetoric.
Do we see any trends in what might be happening in these people's lives here in the UK to make them want to travel abroad? What kind of people are they? What kind of social demographic mix are we looking at?
So we like to try to find overarching stereotypes, overarching trends. We can definitely tend to say that the younger male category, possibly second, third generation immigrant Muslim families. But that being said, there are a lot of examples that go against these stereotypes. People from across different socioeconomic backgrounds are going abroad to fight. We have some instances of people that have no Muslim heritage whatsoever that are being converted and going over to fight. So it's really hard to create a stereotypical person other than younger male, which tends to be an overriding theme. But we are also witnessing women that are going abroad to either be a part of the conflict or propose themselves as wives of jihadists. We have seen a couple cases of this as well. So what we can say is that the first point of contact in radicalization is still very much an offline contact. It is a real world contact. So we do have people that are actively recruiting across Europe. And what that means is there are places of vulnerability where these people feel that they can recruit more easily, whether that is on a university campus, within prison systems. We see a lot of radicalization taking place in prisons. Mosques are also areas of vulnerability. However, it's less likely that you're going to get overt radicalization from within a mosque. Usually people just target the community around a mosque. In the early 2000s, we saw some cases of this, but really now people are very wary. Muslim communities don't want radicalized preachers in their mosque. They don't want this trend happening. But we do see the offline allure and propaganda. And once that first point of contact is made, the individual is driven online where they can find all the supplementary education, the warped version of interpreting the Quran. So this is a facilitator and a secondary tool.
Does the economy or economics play any factor in this? Are we looking at people who may have a depressing view of their own life prospects here?
More than a specific socioeconomic background, I think that perhaps the young adult background is more important, because we are seeing a generation of young adults where we're the first generation that are most likely not going to make as much money as our parents. The job market is difficult. It's hard to identify and feel important or needed or special a lot of times as a young adult across Europe, but around a lot of the world as well. And so more than being economically disadvantaged, perhaps it's more of an emotive response where joining this cause gives you a cause, it gives you strength, it gives you a group to identify with, and it gives you a sense that you're doing something to better the world. That's what they are promoting through the propaganda.
All of these themes you're describing are incredibly complicated, diverse, as you say, hard to generalize. That makes it almost impossible, surely, for the government to get on top of this, to stop this radicalization trend.
Well, that's not necessarily the case, because the government will always be a step behind if we are using reactive actions. What that means is when we see online content we deem as illegal, to try to take it down. We already see the Foley video. It has been taken down numerous times, but even I've seen it just this morning, because we can always find a way. So taking down things off the internet or trying to make sure that voice isn't apparent is never going to be the way to get rid of a voice, especially when we're talking about an ideology. You can't suppress an ideology. We've seen that throughout history. However, if we're proactive in creating an alternative voice, that is much more powerful, and we're not actually doing that at the moment. Governments have not been very good at giving themselves a voice and explaining why they're supporting one thing and not another, why action is being taken more in depth. But more than that, we're also not seeing a very loud community online and offline. So with other areas of xenophobia, when we look at racism, sexism, homophobia, if someone were to say something online or offline that was offensive in that manner, you would have a huge community backlash that would attack that narrative. And we're not seeing that with Muslim fundamentalism and Islamist extremism currently. We have a very vocal minority and a very silent majority. And that could actually, if we could shift that majority to be more vocal, we could actually shift that tide a little bit.
Counterterrorism expert Erin Saltman with FSN's Ollie Barrett. And that's the Wednesday edition of FSN Reports. If you'd like to get in touch with the programme, email us reports@featurestory.com. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside Rebecca Foster with The Bulletin. For everyone with Feature Story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.